Accession number 30085, Reel 1.
Right, here we go. This is Nicholas Gibbs and it's Reel 1. So if I could ask you first of all, then, Nicholas, to tell me something about your background, your family background. I know you come from a military family, don't you?
Very much, but how far do you want me to go back?
Well, your grandfather, I've seen his picture in World War One.
Well, a lot of the family were in the Coldstream, and when I joined I was the 31st of the family name, and there were probably another 150 cousins who also went into the Coldstream. Grandfather went into the Coldstream in the 1920s, came out in the late 20s, and rejoined when war was imminent, and went off with the BEF to Dunkirk, where he was in the famous rearguard action, and was killed at the canal, which is the defence of, I think it was Warheim. But lots of cousins were also in the Coldstream, and went off to join the other aspects of war, SAS, Long Range Desert Group. Was Aidan Crawley, who was my grandfather's first cousin, who was a connection with Churchill and a lot of the SOE spies, and was captured. But because he was a spy, he altered his name to his brother's name, which was Stafford. And he is the Stafford in The Wooden Horse. And he was escape officer for The Wooden Horse. And in his autobiography, which is Leap Before You Look, he identifies that he was the officer who translated for the senior British officer when all 50 of the great escapers had been executed. He then went on to marry Virginia Cowles, who was the American war correspondent, and that was in the end, towards the end of the war. He became Minister of Air in the Labour government. Wrote a definitive book on his RAF escapes and became a television documentary maker and a Conservative MP too. So that was Aidan Crawley. And there was Martin Gibbs, who was Long Range Desert Group, and you can see him with a beard in many of the pictures when they all stand in group photographs. And then another hundreds of cousins that you will see in the Coldstream. My father joined as a National Serviceman in 52, or was it 53, went to Eton Hall, we went to Germany. I was born in London in 57 and went immediately out to Germany when I was about 9 months old. And from then on, my life was military. We lived from one house to the next, military quarters, army quarters. My other grandfather, my mother's father, was at the Battle of Alamein and commanded a battery, and worked on Churchill's staff at the end of the war in the cabinet rooms.
What was his name?
He was Brigadier Howell in the War Office, but at the end of the war they gave him an honorary rank of colonel, because I think at the end of the war you were demoted, so to speak, because of, I think, pensions or pay or... But I was told by my uncle that before the cabinet rooms were open, they left everything as it was. And they left it as the day that they all left the office at the end of the war. And on the desk is Colonel Howell, Brigadier Howell, is away on leave, and there was his address on the desk. But I have photographs of the war rooms as they were when he was there. And various bits and pieces of paper. He took one of Churchill's writing pages, so I got number 10 Downing Street on there, which is a good souvenir.
Have you been back to the war rooms?
Never.
Oh, you must go, because there's now, you know, they've been sort of redone.
So I gather.
And there's an exhibition of the times, Churchill in particular.
But I do the awful thing, I refuse to pay for exhibitions.
Well, perhaps as you're an Imperial War Museum artist,
perhaps
that
gives me free entry to everything. But I feel that if I have to pay for something, I have to see it with a whole group of people, and that takes away the atmosphere. As with my paintings, everything has to be alone, secret, as if I am the first person to discover something. And I often used to go to art exhibitions, but if you go to art exhibition with hundreds of people, you might as well see a photograph of the paintings, because you have to struggle to see the paintings. So I never go.
But I've interrupted your background. You spent a lot of years in Germany then?
Yes. We came back to England when we lived at Krefeld to start with. And then we came back to England, and my father was in at Purbright. And then he became adjutant at Mons. And then we went back out to Germany, and we lived in Iserlohn. And that is actually my first real memories of childhood, as the army quarters. And I went to an army school. Germany was strangely still very divided. It was. I remember going to see the bomb sites. That's what I was fascinated in at the time.
Yes. So what date would this have been when you became really interested in the
65?
Yes, it's quite soon after the war, wasn't it, when you think of it? The 45, yes.
Well, I remember as a child, because whenever my father had leave, we would drive. And being in Germany, you could drive anywhere, as far as the Iron Curtain. But we would mainly go down to France or Italy. And I remember the Italian autostradas had only just started to be built. And we were the first car, I remember, on one of the autostradas. But what I do remember is going over the Alps, and there were no tunnels in those days. But I remember going through a village that was totally destroyed. And I asked my mother where everybody was. And my mother said the Germans had shot everybody. So that was my first memory of devastation. And I still get goosebumps now thinking about that. And I remember seeing also in a ravine a brick bridge which had been blown up by the partisans. The whole archway had landed in its entirety in the ravine, in the river, with a railway engine beside it. And that still hadn't been cleared up, 20 years after the war. Today it would have been cleared up within a week or so.
Yes,
but it was extraordinary.
Some of your later images would remind you, there are links there, I would imagine. The Mostar Bridge
Mostar Bridge. And I had a cousin who was also a war artist in Mostar at the time of the fighting there. She went out as a relief column delivering medical supplies. And when she got out there, she sent back for her paintings and stayed there for 5 months.
What was her name?
Laura Buxton. And she's one of the sort of banking Buxtons who, what are they called? Quakers.
Your education, how early did you show an interest and aptitude for art? In these army schools that you were attending?
Very late. I didn't paint a proper picture until I was 18. Mm-hmm. But my grandmother used to teach, or used to have us, my brother and sister, painting in her studio. And we did just children's. And I remember one of the pictures I painted was a steam engine. I was very keen on steam engines.
So is there a tradition of art in your family, as well as the military?
I suppose, yes, we've gone towards the arts. My forebearer was a patron of the arts in the Victorian times. Was a great patron of the arts, in fact, and paid for many buildings, church buildings. He was a great philanthropist.
And who was that?
He was William Gibbs, and he built Keble College, Oxford, and built part of Lancing, and the chapel was his and his son's gift to the college. And the big house, Tinsfield, which was sold to the National Trust, 4 years ago. But he restored and built 80 churches throughout England. Because his wife, the Crawley side, were the foremost people in the Oxford movement. And they were the money behind the Oxford movement. Very, very religious. Very high church. And therefore a lot of Gibbses went into the church.
Well, a fascinating family background, a lot to live up to.
Absolutely.
I would think. And interesting, this mix of militarism and art,
and
you know,
art.
The influences on you.
Well, they go together, and I think I've written in one of my projects to television, there are two main things about art, and one is war, and the other one is love or emotion. So,
yes. So your education, did you go to university?
I went to university, but I went to a prep school. I was sent back from Germany to a prep school, which was called Skatecliff, where, strange enough, a lot of war heroes went to. And I can't think of anything off by hand, but if you go through the records, there were various DSOs, there were SOE people. I'm trying to think. The headmaster, in fact, had been in the Coldstream in the war. And it's where Richard Branson went. So, and from Skatecliff, although I was put down for Eton, I failed Eton and went to Harrow instead, where all my Crawley cousins went. And I suppose art then began to come into my life then, because various friends that I had at the time were budding artists. And in fact, strange enough, out of the group that I was, my contemporaries at Harrow, about six of us all have become artists and are reasonably well known now. And that's the biggest amount of artists in one actual set of contemporaries that have ever been from the school.
So would there have been good art teaching there?
I'm not sure about art teaching. I think it was more ideas. It was more what you were looking at. Because I certainly didn't take anything to heart that the art master told us. And in fact, the art lessons were a good gap between other lessons. In fact, it was an idea. It was an ideal time to relax rather than actually learn. But I made great friends of who was exact contemporary, Piers de Lazare, who was grandson of de Lazare painter. And there was Nick Healy Hutchinson, Hugh Hales, Pakenham Mahon. There was Nigel Crawley, a cousin. I think who else there was? Mark Error, who's a sculptor. And strange enough, nearly all of us were in the same class together, which is the famous fourth form which Churchill was in.
Did this continue at university? Did you continue looking?
No, I continued looking. I started looking at art when I was at university. But university was a gap year. It was not really to learn. It was not academic. It was basically to learn about life. And so we mainly skied. And we learnt how to grow up. And we learnt the ways of the world, rather than being mollycoddled by parents or whatever. And then when one came back, I joined the army.
And Coldstream?
Coldstream, I was sponsored by the Coldstream. I did what was called Brigade Squad, which is now no longer. And every potential officer went through a Brigade Squad or university. And if you've seen the film Officer and a Gentleman with Richard Gere, that is what we went through. But I gather the stuff that we did, the American Marines refused to do, so we were told it was so dangerous that they refused to say.
So you were toughened up then?
We were toughened up, and at the end of it, we felt as though we could defeat anybody.
Mm. And had you no intention of making a career in the military?
I had, absolutely. Just following family tradition. But I signed up for basically a 3-year commission. I took what's called the Queen's Shilling, and so which means you're under military law. And the Queen's Shilling in those days was, I think, £2.50. I think it's £10 an hour through inflation.
So after the 3 years, did you not want to stay?
No, I didn't. I lasted 6 months.
Oh!
So that was the end of that. And I was absolutely, because they failed me, and I was devastated. So therefore, what was I to do next? And I eventually joined, as a general dog's body, the National Association for Freedom, which was an organisation that was very right-wing, and my cousin was managing director.
And who was he?
He was John Gurrier. And, well, he's married to a cousin, so he is a cousin by marriage. You had Delisle, who was chairman, who was the VC. You had the, Norris McWhirter, because Ross McWhirter had been assassinated a couple of years before. You had Field Marshal Sir Gerald Templar, who I fell downstairs on top of. You had the Balcombe Street siege people, what are they called? The Matthews on the committee, Winston Churchill, Michael Ivans. There were a whole series of rightists.
Mm. What was the aim of this organisation? Why did you join this?
Because it was money, and it was I was just a general expert. I delivered messages, I helped print the newspaper, I helped everything, in fact. I dealt with the switchboard, and I was paid £127 a month, which I suppose in those days you could live on just. And everything was, all the offices were bomb protected. And it dealt with all the dissidents of Russia and, at that time, Czechoslovakia. And they all used to, all the dissidents who'd been exiled used to come into the office. And I remember Bukowski, who was very adamant to tell and preach the whole world of what he belonged to. And we dealt with Grunwick, which was the closed, which is the thing that brought closed shop to the forefront. I remember going to Grunwick when three little Pakistani women were set in a vehicle at the gates. They were picketing, and that picketing then brought in the secondary picketing. I remember getting the riots, and we delivered all the packages secretly. But then was the time I started to doodle, to paint, and I was interested in the theatre, so I wanted to do stage scenes. And since this was going to sort of a dead end job, I then joined Christie's. So I really did get into the art world. And I dealt with what was called the back door, which was bringing in all the art that ever came into the building that was packed up from people's houses in tea chests. And I was responsible for getting everyone to unpack it, and I then had to divide it all up to which department it should go to. And that was fascinating, because some of the stuff we went through were artist studios. And I went, I did Sir Gerald Kelly. I did Anton Locke, which was absolutely fascinating. I did Russell Flint. I did the daughter of Colonel Doyle, who sold all her farm stuff off. And therefore I saw all the Colonel Doyle stuff left over. A lot of the great painters or the pictures used to come in to be transferred to King Street, because I was Christie's South Kensington, and so I handled those. And it was a magnificent time. And the only house sale I did was Enid Bagnall, and we went down to her house in Rottingdean, and she was still there. And I catalogued the entire library, which was wonderful. Half the house had been designed by Lutyens, especially the library. And she was an old lady, and there was a room within a room. She had glass doors in a square in the middle of the room. And she came out one day in her two walkie sticks. She said, "When's the ambulance coming?" And I was poleaxed, didn't know what to answer her. But 2 hours later, the ambulance came, carried her away, and you knew that was the last time she'd ever see the house. But it was a magnificent house, all rotting. Burne Jones, it had been Burne Jones's house beforehand. And upstairs in the bedroom were little paintings of ducks and cats in the corner, only about 3 feet up. And the story that the nurse gave us was that Burne Jones, when he told his children to stand in the corner, at least they had something to look at. So that was wonderful. Strange enough, I saw many of those paintings were cut out of the walls and sold. And about 2 years ago, I was down in Mells and went to the Asquith house, and Lord Asquith was showing us all the paintings in the house, and I told him this story, and he said, "Well, that is a painting that came from one of the walls." So that was magnificent.
Yes, a privilege, really.
Oh, a great privilege.
Yes. And were you painting at this time? Was it inspiring you to
do things? Started to paint on cigar boxes, which one of the secretaries brought in, and I would soak all the paper off the cigar boxes. And you'll find just a couple. I kept a couple around the corner, and I'd paint sort of mythological scenes on them. and I used to give them away as presents. And then I got disillusioned with Christie's, because I could see myself stepping into dead men's shoes, and dead men were not about to die, or rather the live men were not about to die, because most of the directors were reasonably young, and there were at least 20 years, if not 30 years, in most of them. And you only went up the scale when they left or died. And it was then I decided I wanted to be a writer. So I went off to Suffolk, and I started painting on bits of junk furniture, and that's when it really took hold. And I went to Halesworth, where I rented a house from friends of my parents, and I painted and dealt in junk furniture, and also met some fascinating people up there, because it was full of sort of retired actors and retired people who'd lived in the last century as well. They were all in their 80s and 90s. There was a wonderful old guy who'd been the youngest critic on Broadway and talked about the Hollywood stars non-stop. It was the time of Brideshead Revisited. It was the time of the Falklands War.
Ah, oh, you should have had a tape recorder with you, I think, with all these stories.
I would love to. In fact, I should have had a video camera.
Yes. That would have been better still.
But people are very very reticent about appearing in front of a camera.
Yes, I think, you know, sound is better. Much more relaxed, isn't it? Yes. So were you selling your art, your junk furniture, you know, repainted? And
I was trying to, yes, because these friends who I rented the house off had a sort of antique shop junk, and I put some of that in their shop, and it did sell very little money, but it was gripping. And then I came back to London, and what did I do? Interior decorating. And I did all the sort of things that made money in those days, which were special paint finishes, marbling. I was taught by one of John Fowler, of Colfax Fowler's assistants. And so I started all special paint finishes, and then it grew into murals. And murals then grew into canvases. And I reached a particular age when everybody needs to buy their own house, and all my friends were doing that, and I looked at a mortgage and I thought, then I'm trapped, because it means so much money each month, and an artist never makes so much money each month. Artist makes sometimes none, sometimes a lot, and so on. So I got a mortgage, and I lived in Battersea for 9 years, and I lived on baked beans most of the time, because a mortgage was what crippled me was the black, whatever it was, Monday or with Norman Lamont.
And the high interest rates, yes.
It went from, my mortgage was, what, 500 then, it went up to 900 in 1 month. And suddenly you have to find that, and I thought, I'm not going to deal with this. And so I put the flat on the market, and it was in Battersea. It was 4 bedrooms. If I kept it now, it'd be worth $500,000. But I thought, I don't want to spend the rest of my life struggling to pay a mortgage. And in fact, I would still be paying the mortgage today if I had stayed. And it was an endowment, so I would be in trouble at the end of it. So I sold it. And I thought, right, I'm going to do what I've always wanted to do, which is paint for myself, not commissions. I don't like being told what colour the tree should be. And I'd painted in America, I painted murals in America, and I'd always had battles with my clients, because they always wanted something different. They wanted their way of painting, and they wanted me to be the hand, and they were going to be the director. And that always ended up in arguments, because you were never allowed your own free hand. And therefore, the product, the end product, was your responsibility, and although it was your art work, your client would claim, if it was good, all credit, and if it was bad, they would say, well, it's just this person's thing. So I sold the flat, and I moved all my furniture to a friend's house in Herefordshire, and I took a flight to Croatia, just like that. I didn't know what I was getting myself into, but I had a book which my grandparents had, which was The Allied Armies Through Italy by Edward Seeger. And I loved his stuff. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I paint, so that is what I'm going to do. I can't be told what to do there. I can paint what I like.
What date would this have been, Nicholas?
93.
Did you know anything about Croatia and what was going on at that time?
Yes, and that was why I'd always wanted to go to a war zone, but never had had the money, or rather never had the time, because if an artist goes and does something without money coming in, there is a huge gap where no money is there, and then it takes another month for money to come in yet again, because whilst you're doing one job, you're looking for another at the same time, so you must have something to follow on. If you take a holiday, so to speak, you can't look for another job, so therefore you have 2 months of gap, and if you're paying a mortgage, you can't manage that. So I took Croatian Airlines out, and I was slightly nervous of it, because it was Eastern Bloc, third world country sort of airlines, but was quite happy when I got on, because I found it was owned by Lufthansa, so and we landed at Zagreb airport, which was a whacking great mass of concrete, and this was Easter, I think, I can't remember what month it was. There was a huge UN aircraft on the tarmac, and it had that old-fashioned way of transporting the passengers. The aircraft went to the edge of the field, and a whacking great flat bus, it looked like somebody squashed the bus, came out to meet us, and you all got onto the bus, and it took us to the terminal, which was, again, rather like a sort of provincial airport, flat, low building. Almost looking like turnstiles in a stadium, and you go through with very strange officials in strange uniforms with funny collars, looking very severe, almost Soviet. And we all stood in line, and everything was silent, and it was dark inside as well. That was the other thing that struck me. No electricity at all. And you carried your own bags, nothing was moving, so obviously they'd had a power strike. And you were asked whether you brought any money into the country, and I said yes, and I'd taken £200 with me. And my credit card, I was so naive, my credit card. Then I was directed to change my money, because obviously they wanted foreign exchange, and I had to change all my money, and I was given a chit to say how much money I changed. And I was given, I think, 2 million, what was it, dinar. Which is a great wadge of money. As I was told afterwards, for God's sake, don't count the notes. Look at the colour of the notes, because that's how you tell. Because otherwise you'd be there to Kingdom Come just paying for a loaf of bread. So, given this money, and then I thought, right, the forecourt outside, what do I do next? So I got into a taxi and asked whether he spoke English, and he said, little bit. So I said, take me to a hotel. I didn't know where he was going to take me. So he took me to the Panorama Hotel, which was one of the tallest buildings in Zagreb, and I did think it was prime target to anything that was going to come in. It had a whacking great chimney beside it of an energy generator, like Battersea, it was a power station. So I thought, right, and it was painted red and white stripes, so I thought, ideal advertisement for knocking it out. And I was put on the 13th floor, which didn't suit me either. It was one of those typical sort of European rooms with a sort of cold concrete floor. Bathroom, no plugs, no soap. When I had a bath, I tried to plug up using loo paper, and I got bundles of new hair. And so when I got into the bath, the whole thing disintegrated. Thank God I had my own soap.